Hello, beautiful people. This is the Michael Slate Show, and I am your guest host, Sansara Taylor. On today's show, we'll be sharing segments from the RNL Revolution Nothing Less show, which airs on YouTube. Let's begin.
Welcome to the RNL, the Revolution Nothing Less show. And my name is Sansara Taylor. I'm joined by Annie Day.
This show is about an actual revolution to overthrow this whole system of capitalism, imperialism, and bring a fundamentally different, a radically better world into being.
We base ourselves on the new communism and the leadership of Bob Avakian. Bob Avakian is a leader like no other who has ever existed in the history of this country and no one else alive on the world today. He is the architect of a whole new framework of human emancipation. He's developed the strategy for a real revolution here, and he's developed the framework, the understanding, the scientific approach to make this revolution here and revolutions around the world lasting and emancipatory for all of humanity.
And we're going to hear more directly from Bob Avakian later in today's episode about what's new in the new communism. And we're going to have an interview with a volunteer and a professor with the Bob Avakian Institute about the significance of this new communism and why it urgently needs to be engaged now.
We're going to start our show by taking a look at the crucial turning point that we are in with the rapid pace of fascism, Trump MAGA fascism consolidating in this country, and the very high stakes of people, the decent people in this country, the tens of millions of us stepping out, standing up in the streets, taking this on and demanding that this regime be removed from power now. We really are in a pivot point in history.
Actually, let's start with Steve Bannon, the fascist ideologue and architect, talking about just this.
What is one thing you want to see in the next 100 days?
Just more of the double down, more of the same. I do want to see there's going to be a confrontation. I think the convergence of the financial issue of the big, beautiful bill, particularly of spending cuts, and the simultaneously constitutional crisis that we're hurtling to is going to make this summer a summer like no other.
Think about that. They intend to double down in their fascism, and you're seeing it every day. ICE raids in courthouses, Trump attacking, threatening high school age trans athletes, arresting judges and Congress people and mayors. And yes, in each case, there is significant protest and outrage. But what is missing, what people need to understand, is that we cannot fight this fascism item by item, outrage by outrage. We have to recognize that this regime has to be driven from power, that the single unifying demand that has to reverberate in the streets and in every institution has to be the Trump fascist regime must go now.
The reason this is so important is Trump has made clear that as long as he's in power, he is going to bulldoze over any obstacle. That's what Steve Bannon was talking about, but that's what Trump has demonstrated. The courts tell him you can't deport these people. He does it anyhow. The Supreme Court says you got to bring Abrego Garcia back. Ignored. He is not letting any obstacle stand in his way, and Congress is not stopping him. There's no institution, even the institution standing up against him. They can only hold out for so long. Harvard, we're rooting for you. But Trump is circling, tightening the noose on them. There's got to be an offense from every corner of society, demanding the removal of this regime and not stopping. Yes, nonviolent, but ferocious, determined, relentless, and growing struggle. And it has to take a leap soon. So one of the things we want to talk about right now is a major leap in the Nazification of this society, a major leap towards fascism happening on June 14th. This is Trump's birthday. It's the 250th anniversary of the U.S. military, and it is the occasion on which Donald Trump is throwing himself a fascist military parade through the streets of D.C.
That's right. Almost 7,000 soldiers are going to be marching with tanks, with Apache helicopters flying overhead, and it's all leading up to the point where they're going to give Trump a flag as part of the proceedings of the day.
Just to really take stock in what this means, the military is the iron backbone of the state. It is the fighting force. It is enforcing the U.S. military and the U.S. power and domination throughout the world. And it is a concentration of what kind of country, what kind of society, what kind of ethos, what kind of morality this country is going to have. The U.S. military has carried out war crimes and crimes against humanity from the founding of this country with George Washington and the crusades and starvation inflicted on Native peoples and massacres down to the Vietnam War and the crimes against humanity and the millions who were slaughtered there by the U.S., to the criminal war on terror, Iraq war, all of these things, to right now with the backing of the genocide in Gaza. It's been a bloody history. But one thing that has existed up till now is the U.S. military has been loyal to the system as a whole. It has been nonpartisan in that sense. And during Trump's first regime, he tried to throw himself a military parade, and really reactionary, high-powered generals, U.S. military generals, stopped him. James Mattis, James Mad Dog Mattis, who was a war criminal. He led the Battle of Fallujah in the Iraq War, the second Iraq War. This is a battle where they wrapped the entire city in barbed wire and told people, leave town or die, and they shot everything that moved, anybody who didn't leave. So he's a war criminal. Donald Trump wanted to throw himself a military parade during the first Trump regime. James Mattis said no. He said, I would rather drink acid than let Trump throw himself a military parade. Now, why did he do this? Again, he wanted to preserve the U.S. military being loyal to the rule of law and the Constitution, not to an individual fascist leader and an ideological white supremacist, openly MAGA movement. And this is, there's nobody now to stop Trump. He's going forward with this.
And this is not just symbolic. I mean, Trump has been moving since day one to Nazify the military. I mean, look at who he put as defense secretary, who he appointed as defense secretary is this guy, Pete Hegseth, who is an open Christian fascist.
This is precisely where I need to be. And I think exactly where we need to be as a nation at this moment, in prayer, on bended knee, recognizing the providence of our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ, knowing that there's an author in heaven overseeing all of this, who's underwritten all of it for us on the cross, gives me the strength to proceed and to look out at this audience and know there are so many others online here at the Defense Department who share that understanding of appealing to heaven for that guidance, for that wisdom, for that courage. Gives me strength.
Who has fought for years to be able to have the military openly violate any rules of law, has worked to get people who'd been convicted of war crimes to be pardoned by Trump, which he did all throughout Trump 1.0, who said that any ability, any way in which you have to abide by international laws against war crimes is why the U.S. has not won a war since World War II. Hegseth wrote a book called American Crusades, and he upholds the crusades that were waged in the 11th century by the Catholic Church. This is the time where they waged, you know, basically holy wars against anybody that the Catholic Church deemed infidels. And what does Hegseth say in his book called American Crusade? Is he basically envisions a war on leftists in the U.S. as a modern day crusade. And he writes, this time in our history calls for an American crusade. Yes, a holy war for the righteous cause of human freedom. And what he means as human freedom is an openly theocratic, openly male supremacist, white supremacist society that he intends to enforce through violence.
I just want to underscore, I mean, that's a chilling quote. Hegseth is talking about a crusade, a holy war on U.S. soil. And when he talks about radical leftists, they cast a very wide net when they talk about radical leftists. They're talking about a judge appointed by Ronald Reagan, in their view, is a lunatic radical leftist. So this is a very serious and dangerous situation. This is what they're marching through. D.C., U.S. soil, military parade on June 14th. And this is why it's going to be opposed. Trump has already purged the leadership of the military, of black leaders, of women leaders, of anybody who even gave lip service to overcoming racial and gender discrimination within the military. They have planned a purge of trans troops on June 6th, the first week of Pride Month. I want you to listen to what Donald Trump said at West Point during a commencement address he gave this past week.
They sent our warriors on nation-building crusades to nations that wanted nothing to do with us, led by leaders that didn't have a clue in distant lands while abusing our soldiers with absurd ideological experiments here and at home. All of that's ended. You know that. All of it's ended. It's ended strongly, ended. They're not even allowed to think about it anymore.
Think about that. He's saying you won't even be allowed to think. Not even allowed to think about overcoming gender and racial discrimination. He is remolding this military to be an actively, openly white supremacist, male supremacist, Christian fascist fighting force loyal to him, above the rule of law, not bound by the Constitution, and not and purged of any other authority who would stand in his way. And this is why it is so important. It is so important that there are protests that have been called across the country on this day. Indivisible has called for protests. Other groups are joining with it. Over 700 cities already are planning protests under the banner, No Kings. And this is righteous and it's important. But we also have to inject into these protests, it is crucial, the demand that the Trump fascist regime must go now. This is not just a vanity project of Trump trying to become a king. This is a Nazification of the military and a leap towards fascist consolidation in this country. And the regime has to be called out as a whole. The fascism has to be opposed, and it has to be done nationwide, but it also has to be done in Washington, D.C., where this is going down.
Yeah, and it really matters that this demand that the Trump fascist regime must go now is manifest all across the country as a determined sense of mission, and that it manifests in the streets of Washington, D.C., while these fascists are tromping through the Capitol with their military. This is why it's really important that Refuse Fascism is calling for uniting with these protests across the country and calling for protests in D.C. itself on June 14th. There has to be a bold and serious repudiation of this Nazification of the military and Trump's, you know, celebratory parade. Refuse Fascism has gotten a permit. It's going to be a determined protest. It's going to be a nonviolent protest. It's going to be early in the day, but it is going to be in the streets of D.C. to send this message so that all across the country that there is a split screen when the newspapers cover this, when the nightly news covers this. There has to be, you know, the pictures of protests all across the country, and there has to be the sense and the image of the forces in the streets of D.C. saying, no, we are not going to allow this to go down. So let me ask you, Sansara, Indivisible, one of the groups that have called this No Kings Day, has said that they've called for these national protests for everywhere but D.C. And so Refuse Fascism is uniting with that, but also saying, no, it also has to be in D.C. And I'd like you to speak to, I think some of the logic of this is, or what people say anyway, is if we protest them in the streets, it will bring down, it will give Trump an excuse to come down with a repression, or, oh, this might mean that they'll call for martial law. How would you answer that?
Well, you want to see martial law advance, you let a military parade headed by Donald Trump go unopposed in the seat of power. You need to stand up to this. Yes, you know, we're calling for nonviolent protest, Refuse Fascism is, and we're not looking for a confrontation, but there does have to be a political opposition right there in the seat of power standing up to this, because the more you bow down, the more you cower and stand away from taking this on directly, the more it advances. And so it's righteous and it's really important. I mean, it's so important that there's protests nationwide, and we need more of them, and we support them, and people should go out to them. RevCom should go out to them. People with Refuse Fascism should go out to them. Bring the slogan, the Trump fascist regime must go now, everywhere. But we do have to be in D.C., and we have to be building up strength in D.C., not just on June 14th, but going forward. We need a movement that's going to unseat this regime through mass nonviolent political protest and sustained struggle. And it's going to have a major center of struggle in D.C. So we have to be doing this now, and it has to be growing all summer long.
I mean, I think it's a heavy thing, because I think people are confronting, when we think about the fascism and what we're facing, there's a lot of fear, mm-hmm. and that's understandable. But I think it's important to think about the actual danger of what we're facing and what it will mean for the people of the world if we allow this fascism to consolidate. And in the face of that, the need for heroism, the need for self-sacrificing courage, and the need to come together. Mm. And actually, you know, this is some of the power of the call from Refuse Fascism is in our numbers, to come together, to have each other's backs, to have the backs of the people of the world, and raise the slogan, in the name of humanity, we refuse to accept a fascist America.
You know, another thing that's very important about being in DC protesting and nationwide is, if you think about the US military and who makes it up, it is over 40% people of color. It's over 20% women. And there's other people in the military who these changes, this Nazification, does not sit well with them. There are people for whom they may find ways to give expression to their opposition, who may not feel so ready and willing to carry out illegal, unconstitutional orders, to carry out war crimes, to be unleashed on U.S. soil against the Constitution. But it's going to matter if there's opposition in society calling this out and calling out the regime as a whole. The more powerful the resistance is in the streets, the more it's going to repolarize every institution and give backing to those who are against this to find the ways to stand up to it. And that's part of what comes together and could come together from the street and then echoing and ricocheting in the halls of power and within every institution to create the kind of political crisis where the regime is forced out. We don't know exactly how that's going to happen, and that's not going to happen on June 4th. We're not predicting that on June 14th, but we have to be moving towards that, and we have to be raising the demand, and we have to be rallying people's courage and their sustained outpourings in opposition. And so June 14th, we have to make a leap in this. That's what we are fighting for and calling on everybody to be part of.
Yeah, so to put it back, not in the way Bannon means, just the opposite, but it does have to be a summer like no other. So go to refusefascism.org, sign up, get organized wherever you are, and if you're anywhere near D.C., get to D.C.
Once again, let me remind you that you are listening to The Michael Slate Show.
We're in the middle of a revolution because I see the face of things to come. Oh, your constitution, well, my friend, it's gonna have to bend. I'm here to tell you about the destruction of all the evil it will have to end. Some folks are gonna get the notion, I know. They'll say I'm preaching hate. If I have to swim the ocean, well, I will, just to communicate. It's not as simple as talk and jive, the daily struggle just to stay alive. Because I'm talking about a change. It's more than just air pollution. Well, you know, you've got to clean your brain. The only way that we can stand, in fact, is when can you get your foot off my back?
Earlier this year, when I sat down with Bob Avakian and had the chance to interview him about the current situation we face and the new communism he's brought forward, I asked him, what is new? What's the big deal about the new communism? What is new and different in it? We want to play for you now that portion of the interview where he answers this question.
And we're going to follow that up with an interview with John Hedlund, a sociology professor and a volunteer with the Bob Avakian Institute, about the new communism and why he's fighting for people to engage this seriously.
I want to come back to the part of ways in which you've gone further, since you helped me with the further or farther, ways that you've gone further than communism as it was understood and as it has been carried out before the new communism.
Obviously, that's a big, very big subject, you know, and I've written about this, for example, in a work of mine, Breakthroughs, which you can get at revcom.us. And it talks about the initial historic breakthrough made by Marx, which I've referred to, and then the further breakthrough with the new communism. In the initial conception of communism and in the social societies that were brought into being on the basis of attempting to apply communism, first in the Soviet Union, beginning in, after the revolution in 1917, up until the mid-50s, when capitalism was restored there, and then in China with the success of the revolution in 1949 until, as I said, after Mao's death in 1976, capitalism was restored there. And you can see from the fact that I'm talking about the revolution being made and capitalism being restored, that this is a tremendous process of struggle against the old world and all the old ways, which are always, you know, working and being and poised to spring back and come back into power and reverse all the emancipating gains that the revolution has achieved. It would take a long time, and I have written extensively, to go into all of this. But, you know, the basic thing is, in the, you know, development of the communist movement up through the Chinese Revolution, there were certain concepts like, you know, the idea of reification, for example, of the working class or the proletariat. The idea that by its mere position in society as the exploited class, and this was applied more broadly to exploited and oppressed people in society, by mere virtue of their position and the conditions to which they were subjected, those people who were part of that class more or less spontaneously came to, had the right idea about where things ought to go. And you see a lot of that now, you know, in a lot of the postmodernist thinking, you know, has picked up with some of these ideas of, you know, like, you know, now it's not so much the proletariat, it's different identities, you know, and each identity knows because of its own lived reality. You know, it knows what the answer to its situation is. You know, and there was a lot of that in the communist movement, the kind of reification, as it's called, where the idea was that the proletariat sort of spontaneously would come to an understanding of, you know, where its interests lie and why it needs to make revolution and how it needs to make revolution and so on. There was some of that in Marx and Engels. You know, Lenin struggled against some of that in leading the Russian Revolution, but there's still some of that that went through the history of the communist movement up through the Chinese Revolution. And that's wrong. What also went along with that, was a notion of, you know, that was, you know, somewhat propagated of the inevitability of the victory of the communist revolution. You know, some even said we're condemned to, you know, to achieve communism. Well, unfortunately, no. You know, there is no great mover in history. You know, one of the things, communists are atheists because they're scientific and they understand there are no supernatural beings and forces. But some of a little bit of the same idea crept into the communist movement in the sense that there's some sort of history with a capital H that's moving everything toward communism, you know, basically inevitably. And that's not true. It's a matter of struggle. And the outcome of that struggle is not determined. It, you know, it's whatever, you know, people who become conscious of the need for this revolution and lead masses of people is whatever they are able to achieve versus what of those who are posing and seeking to drown in blood their attempts to make that revolution are able to impose. So, you know, there was, that also needed to be broken with that notion. And it also went along with it, including in the Chinese Revolution. I mean, look, there's a lot of slander against the Cultural Revolution in China, for example. Now, not only did it create great revolutionary culture in which the masses of people making revolution came onto the stage, really for the first time in history, but it, you know, it also gave rise to tremendous, you know, what can be legitimately called mass democracy, with hundreds of newspapers being produced by masses of people in struggle, people doing, you know, putting what were called big character posters, you know, basically political documents up on walls, you know, like the way people pass out, you know, leaflets and posters and things, you know, and now go online, you know, and, you know, put forward their views and carry out struggle. There was a tremendous amount of that which is, you know, ignored, you know, or distorted and slandered. But there was a certain limitation, even though there's a tremendous amount of political ferment through the Chinese Revolution and especially in the Cultural Revolution, there was a certain limitation that this, you know, had to be sort of confined within a framework where the assumption was built in that, you know, that communism was right and that the, you know, the, while you could criticize certain leaders for deviating from communism, you, to be honest, if you were to criticize Mao, for example, then you could get in a lot of trouble. So, you know, there was a tremendous mass upheaval and, you know, mass ferment politically and struggle. But there were also limitations and there were also some excesses. Now, those are greatly exaggerated, the excesses, and they did not characterize this tremendous mass political uprising of literally hundreds of millions of people. But there were these limitations within this, which also related to the idea that, for example, if someone came from an upper class background, they were suspect. You know, even though, you know, Mao himself said, you know, I'm an intellectual, I came from a more privileged background, you know, but he became a communist revolutionary. But still there was this idea that if you came from a more privileged background, you were sort of automatically suspect. And we can see some of the same thing, you know, in the culture now, even though it's not in the name of communism. You know, if you were more privileged, well then, you know, your ideas are suspect. You know, rather than look, whether people's ideas are correct or not is a matter of whether or not they are true, which means whether or not they correspond to reality as it actually is. And yes, as it's moving and changing, but as it actually is. And wherever anybody comes from and whoever they are, their ideas have to be evaluated on the basis of whether they actually correspond to reality or not. And that was one of the limitations in the Cultural Revolution, as great as it was in many ways, was the idea that there's such a thing as class truth. Mm. There's truth that serves the proletariat, and then there's truth, you know, then there are ideas that go against the proletariat, and that's the truth of the bourgeoisie and the capitalist exploiters, and that's no good. And it's tricky because, you know, people who want to enforce exploitation can cite certain things that are true or certain limitations and use those to attack the whole thing. But you still have to thrash all that out and sort all that out on the basis of what's true or not. For example, I read something by Zbigniew Brzezinski, who was a major advisor under Carter, you know, who just died, and, you know, played a very bad role as a, you know, functionary of US imperialism. But he wrote about the Russian Revolution that there was a certain, you know, trend toward, you know, autocracy in the in Russian society, toward, you know, toward tyranny, if you will, and that this, you know, seeped into the Russian Revolution and explained why it was repressive. And I just said, oh, this is bullshit. You know, the whole Russian Revolution was going up against everything about the old society and all the tyranny of the old ruling classes, the czars and the capitalist exploiters in Russia. And then I thought about it a little more and I said, well, There were problems in the Russian Revolution. There were ways in which it became repressive in some ways and suffocated the necessary intellectual and cultural ferment that needed to happen and the ideological struggle over what's true and not and what's a way forward and not. There were, you know, serious, significant problems in that way. So then I wrote and said, well, you know, he has a point. So what's the larger lesson there? I know I'm going on, but I'm trying to give some scope to this so that people can get a sense of the importance of it. You know, I said, well, what's the bigger lesson here? The bigger lesson is even though Zbigniew Brzezinski was a thorough reactionary and a functionary of the most oppressive system in the history of the world, the most, you know, monstrous system in the history of the world, namely U.S. capitalist imperialism, he had a point here. And you couldn't rule out or suppress the point that he had because it came from a bad source. And this is something that's very important to understand. Truth does not depend on who says it. And it doesn't depend on whether you like who says something or not, or whether the overall they're playing a very bad role. What, you know, truth, you know, it has to be examined in the concrete and has to be determined on the basis of whether something actually corresponds to reality. And I've made the statement, which is new about the new communism, that everything that is actually true is good for the revolution, is good for the proletariat, you know, whose fundamental interest of abolishing exploitation and oppression is what this revolution is about. It's good for us as communists, to know the truth, even if those truths make us uncomfortable, unhappy, make us cringe, as I said, in the short run, in the immediate, because only by really, you know, coming to understand reality in the fullest and most scientific way can you actually transform it in the interests of the masses of people and in the interests of moving beyond all this oppression and exploitation. So even if big oppressors say something, it has to be evaluated on whether it's true or not, and not whether, well, they're a bunch of reactionaries, so what they say is going to be bad, even if it might be true. You know, so that this is also a very important part about the new communism.
So I'm joined today by John Hedlund, a sociology professor and volunteer with the Bob Avakian Institute. The Bob Avakian Institute is an educational institute whose mission is to preserve, project, and promote the works and the vision of Bob Avakian, aiming to reach the broadest possible audience. And we work to foster debate and discussion of Avakian's pathbreaking and provocative work. John is a student of the new communism, and in the field of sociology, he focuses on the interaction between the environment and society. And John recently wrote a letter addressed to academics on fighting fascism and the importance of Avakian's work, which he's been sending out to professors and academic listservs. So John, very, very glad you're able to be with us today.
Thanks, Annie. Glad to be here.
So you wrote this letter and are sending it out widely at the very moment that the Trump fascist regime is literally aiming to crush academia. They're threatening professors who speak out. They are demanding that that whole academic departments purge their websites of language that even mentions diversity or inclusion. Protesters are being kidnapped off the streets for writing op-eds. I wanted to ask at this very moment, why was it important for you to stick your neck out and call on people both to join in unity in fighting fascism and to engage the new communism that Avakian has brought forward?
Well, I mean, just practically speaking, it's at no point is it going to become easier to stick your neck out at some future point. You know, now is really a kind of threshold. Societally in this country, but also, you know, and this is said without hyperbole, for the state of humanity. You know, if I'm, you know, as someone who takes ideas seriously, as someone who takes the pursuit of the truth seriously, contestation of ideas seriously, this is, a moment that demands real courage, and it demands real coming together collectively to defend one another, to fight back against these attacks, and to hash out the big questions, the big ideas, and have debates about the kind of world and society we want to bring in that isn't simply a negation of Trump's fascist agenda, as important as that struggle is. So really, it seems like there's no more opportune time than now to be doing things like this. It's not going to get easier. It's not going to get safer. Without sacrifice, without people taking risks, without people stepping out individually, but also more importantly, together, collectively, then things will only get significantly worse.
What stands out to you about the breakthroughs in the new communism that you think people need to know that they don't know?
Well, one of the things that really stood out to me in the recent interviews, particularly part two, where he goes into in some depth the new communism, the concreteness with which he spoke about the new communism and how it would be applied in these different spheres of society, rule of law, right, the legal system, jurisprudence, theory of law, the media, the culture, in academia and the sciences. The new communism is both very, I think, broad and at a very high level of abstraction in terms of dealing with questions of truth, of epistemology, of theories of knowledge, but there's also very concrete application to those breakthroughs in terms of what society would actually look like, how society would be governed, and how society would be not only radically different from the show that we live under today, but radically different from what most people think of as what communism is, and some of that is because there was a lid on how far previous socialist societies were able to go because of a lot of these limitations and shortcomings that Avakian has resolved, but also because a lot of the slanders and bullshit and lies, which he also goes into in the interview and takes on in the interviews as well. So hearing him talk about in this interview and in part two of this interview, talking about, you know, specifically, you know, how would, you know, this framework of the new communism be applied to, for example, the legal system and legal defense, you know, and that in order for there to be a serious contestation of two contending parties, right, of the prosecution and defense, that the defense would be given the same resources, equal to or more than the resources of the prosecution. That is a radical breakthrough, one from this world and this society, but also from anything that came before, you know, in past socialist societies, where if you were challenging, right, something fundamental, and if you were going up against, right, the entrenched ideas of those societies, right, the idea that, for example, that socialism was good and that you had to support socialism, where you were challenging the dominant ideas of the party or the governing bodies at the time, that you would not get a hearing in society broadly, and certainly not in a court of law. And that's a radical breakthrough. And, you know, him talking about, just really frankly talking about the Cultural Revolution, which in China, which I was very inspired by. The Cultural Revolution. It's one of the reasons why I became a communist, was learning about the kind of mass upheaval, the breaking down of divisions between leadership and led, between manager and worker, between men and women, between intellectuals and manual workers, that kind of process, as radical and liberating as it was, there was a ceiling to how far that could go. And he says straight up, you know, if you wanted to challenge Mao, or you wanted to challenge or question socialism itself and that the goal of society should be, and the goal of socialism and socialist society should be, to get to communism and break down all of these divisions. You couldn't really get a hearing unless you cloaked that in the language of socialism and the prevailing ideas of society and the party at the time. And hearing him say that straight up, I mean, that's something I always kind of suspected, but felt like I could, you know, couldn't be said, or else the whole thing would unravel, right? That there would be no socialism left if you challenged, you know, or followed through on that criticism of the Cultural Revolution of the entire first wave of socialist revolutions. That if you pulled that thread out and teased that out and looked at that, you weren't able to challenge certain things, you weren't able to challenge certain leaders or certain ideas, would the entire thing fall apart? You know, would there be no more, you know, would you have to throw socialism and communism out completely? And what I think is so inspiring about the new communism, what Baba Vakian's shown, is that no, you don't have to either dogmatically cling to, you know, every idea and every aspect of the socialist revolutions of the past, that you can challenge them and come out the other side of it with a better, higher, more scientific, and more liberating understanding of what socialism can be, that has a significantly better shot of getting us to communism without throwing the entire thing out. You know, I think that's one of the things that's really inspiring about this interview and about the new communism in general, is that Avakian's willing to go there. And I think very few have been willing to go there unless they were doing so in order to try to you know, throw out the entire thing altogether.
Yeah, it's heavy to hear you walk that through, because then the stakes of it are, if you don't go there, if you don't follow the road that Avakian is hacking out, then you're just turning communism into a religion. And it would be pretty bad if you tried to impose that on society. So you see the stakes of the breakthroughs in the new communism is whether or not humanity has a shot to get out of this dark ages nightmare. So I guess my final question to kind of bring things back together and back to your letter is what do you think it would change if this work were being engaged throughout society and debated? And what are we up against? Because it's not just like, it's not just ignorance, right? So how do you see that in terms of what you're arguing for?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's two ways to think about it. One is the content of what he's saying, which people very much need to engage with, right? That the world doesn't have to be, the world is a horror because of a system that we live under. This system is not inevitable. It was not, you know, endowed by nature or by some god. We can be free of this, and that there's a way to do that that doesn't compromise our humanity, that doesn't compromise our artistic and intellectual, cultural, integrity, you know. But also, you know, and that this is a world that people would really want to live in. But also, there's a question of like ethics and morality and approach too, I think, you know, and that there's so much cynicism. There's so much kind of posturing and posing as kind of people know it all, people have seen it all, you know, there's nothing new under the sun, you know, so either you make peace with this world, or you cling to, you know, like you were saying, you know, dogmatically cling to, you know, something from the past, or you just, you know, make do with being kind of a professional critic or cynic. But people don't know it all. People haven't actually seriously engaged this. And, one of the things that we're up against is that any mention of, communism, new communism, communist leader, you know, and including the person who's brought this forward, Bob Avakian, shuts down critical thinking among large sections of society, particularly among the kind of the intelligentsia, the upper middle class, educated, professional class. So this is really a challenge, not just in terms of getting people to engage with the content, but I also think it's a it's a challenge of approach. It's a challenge of morality. It's a challenge of you know, worldview, and what kind of people we're going to be, you know? So there's a lot, I think, that we still need to work on to figure out how to open people up, you know, how to take on the haters, take on the bullshit, take on the lies, but also how to open people up, right? And kind of how to raise people's sights, not just in terms of a far better world, but even in terms of their ability to look beyond themselves and the way that people have been conditioned to think and feel in this society. So I think, you know, there's a big challenge, even just, I think just, you know, inviting people to engage with Bob Avakian's work is a significant challenge, you know, both to reconsider how the world could be, to raise their own sights, to raise their level of intellectual integrity, to dispense with the cynicism and kind of, you know, faux world weariness that is all too common. So it's a challenge in that sense. But I think what it opens up, you know, is it opens up debate, which is good. We want debate. We want people to debate the content, the ideas, the substance of the new communism, because people are going to have insights that we may not have had, right, about, you know, aspect, you know, they're going to try to poke holes in it. And that's good. That only strengthens, right, the framework. That only strengthens the substance of it. And I also think it can really help advance kind of a fighting spirit in people. The horizon, right, of, you know, an entirely different way that society could be organized. You know, an entirely different relationship between humans in the natural world, between people of different nationalities, between different geographical regions, between different genders, sexual orientations, that the radicalness of what's embodied in the new communism, I think deep down many people are thirsting for, if we can connect them with it and if we can break through all the bullshit, you know. So I think this is really high stakes for getting for kind of meeting our goal of getting people to engage with this in their thousands and in their millions from across society, including people who are trained to work with ideas and who are intellectuals broadly speaking. It's really, really, really important right now.
Well, I agree with that and appreciate that. I wanted to just end with a question you pose in your letter, which I think you've given a really powerful answer to here. But you ask, is there not only a way out, but a way through to a wildly daring yet eminently possible new world? So I, you know, appreciate the challenge for people to have the courage of their convictions and the heart and the morality to seriously get into this. So thank you for joining us today, John. And if people want to know more about the Bob Avakian Institute, they should go to the website and join us for regular Zoom discussions and more.
Yes, absolutely. Thank you, Annie.
You are listening to The Michael Slate Show. We're going to take a short musical break and be right back.
They sentenced me to 20 years of boredom, but trying to change the system from within. I'm coming now, I'm coming to reward them. First, we take Manhattan. Heavens, I'm guided by the take Manhattan.
It was great to see John on the show. It was a really interesting interview, Annie. I want you to think about what John said about what difference it would make if we were able to get Bob Avakian's voice, his leadership out through all the noise, all the distraction, and have thousands and soon millions actually engaging this, the difference it would make in their thinking and in what they are doing, their dreams, their aspirations, and how they are acting. And we need to make a leap, especially now when so many people are questioning. They're agonizing. They're looking for answers in a deeper way than they have for a long time, but they don't know what they have in this leader, Bob Avakian. They are not yet looking for this kind of answers.
So we're not able to do much coverage of the situation in Gaza this week, but we want to point people to the coverage of this on RevCom.us. And just briefly, in the last few days, Israel bombed a school turned shelter, turning it into a blazing inferno, killing almost 50 people. I want you to keep this image seared into your mind. A young girl walking through the fire looking for her family. She survived, but they were all incinerated. And the day before this, a doctor rushed home from the hospital in Khan Yunus, a city in Gaza, after her house was bombed. 9 of her 10 children were killed. The oldest was 12 years old and the youngest was 6 months old. Gaza remains starved, with tiny amounts of aid trickling in as a form of further control. Just in the last couple days, people were forced to walk for miles to get a small amount of aid, and they did so under strict supervision, having eye scans to be able to get the food. And when people started to amass in large numbers because they're so desperately starving and hungry, the Israeli army shot into the crowd. They murdered one person, wounded almost 50, and they terrorized the whole population. This is a genocide. The conscious, active, systematic murder and wiping out of a whole people. And we're watching it live. No one can stand aside from this, but neither can people throw up their hands in despair. What's needed urgently, what must grow urgently, is mass protest growing broader, deeper, and more determined, demanding that the U.S.-Israeli genocide must stop now, that Netanyahu, the fascist Trump regime, must stop now.
So that brings us to the end of today's episode of the Revolution Nothing Less show. We are truly in very heavy times, but they are not times without hope. There is a future to be won. There's a whole different world we could be living in, a radically different emancipatory system, a liberating society on the road to an emancipated humanity. We brought that alive by bringing you Bob Avakian in his interview today. We've confronted what we're up against in the Gaza genocide, in the Trump fascist regime taking leaps forward with their military parade. But we've also put the challenge to each of you, to all of us, what we do or don't do in these times is going to make all the difference for the future. So we're glad that you tuned in. We want you to spread this show to other people who need to see it. Go to our website, revcom.us, and throw in, step up your involvement, reach out to others, and let's fight for the future that we deserve and that humanity deserves.
There's nothing more important and nothing more joyful than coming together to fight for the future. So thank you to the RNL Revolution Nothing Less crew. Thank you for people tuning in. Hit the notification bell, like and spread this show, and we will see you next week.
And that brings us to the end of another show here at the Michael Slate Show. I'd like to thank Andy Z and everybody at the Revolution Nothing Less show, my assistant producer, Henry Carson, and all of you for tuning in.
And again, check out The Rev Comes on YouTube at youtube.com/TheRevComes and follow at Bob Avakian Official on all your social media platforms. And remember, the problem is not human nature, it is the nature of the system. Through a real revolution, a better world is possible. My name is Sansara Taylor. I'll talk to you again next week.
Las calles, que tiemblen los jueces y los judiciales. Hoy a las mujeres nos quitan la calma, nos sembraron miedo, nos crecieron alas. A cada minuto de cada semana nos roban amigas, nos matan hermanas, destrozan sus cuerpos, los desaparecen. No olvides sus nombres, por favor, señor presidente. Por todas las compas marchando en Reforma, por todas las morras peleando en Sonora, por las comandantas luchando por Chiapas, por todas las madres buscando en Tijuana. Cantamos sin miedo, pedimos justicia, gritamos por cada desaparecida.
Que resuene fuerte,
nos queremos vivas.
Que caiga con fuerza
el feminicida.
Yo todo lo incendio, yo todo lo rompo. Si un día algún fulano te apaga los ojos, ya nada me calla, ya todo me sobra. Si tocan a una, respondemos todas. Soy Claudia, soy Esther y soy Teresa. Soy Ingrid, soy Fabiola y soy Valeria.
Soy la niña que subiste por la fuerza.
Soy la madre que ahora llora por sus muertas.
Y soy esta que te hará pagar las cuentas.
Justicia, justicia, justicia.
Por todas las compas marchando en Reforma, por todas las morras peleando en Sonora, por las comandantas luchando por Chiapas,
justicia, gritamos por cada desaparecida.
Que resuene fuerte.